Our subject this morning is three spiritual practices for busy people. Swami Vivekananda tells us in Practical Vedanta that Vedanta as a philosophy and a religion must be understood in light of our everyday lives. If it just remains as a theory, then it's practically just an intellectual concept for us. It has no real value in our lives. So we have to be able to bridge spirituality with our daily lives. Vedanta teaches oneness, and this oneness of existence penetrates every aspect of our life and experience. It's a fact. But to have a practical benefit in our lives and to help us move forward in our spiritual life, Vedanta has to enter every aspect of our lives as a practice, not just on Sunday mornings or on some evenings during the week. You know, as we know, Swamiji emphasized that Vedanta was not intended or meant just for those who live in retirement or for monks and nuns. It's for everyone, regardless of our occupation or our place in life. In fact, some of the most exalted thoughts have come from those who have lived the busiest of lives. Swamiji says as kings and emperors, for example. And he goes so far as to say that in various Upanishads, the Vedanta philosophy was taught by those who were extremely busy in the everyday affairs of life. Therefore, according to him, it should be even more possible for us to put these teachings into practice in our daily lives. Swamiji felt that our lives as compared to those is one of leisure. We are comparatively free. He says our wants are as nothing compared with the demands of Arjuna on the battlefield, commanding a huge army. And yet he found time in the midst of the chaos of battle to discuss the highest philosophy with Sri Krishna. Surely, Swamiji says, we ought to be able to do as much in our life. Most of us have more time than we think we have, if we want to use it for a good purpose, for a higher purpose. Swamiji says, the amount of freedom that we have, we can attain to 200 ideals in this life if we really want to. You know, Swami Brahmananda, one of Sri Ramakrishna's disciples, once asked a monk how his spiritual practices were going. And the monk complained that he didn't have enough time to practice because he had so much work to do. And Swami Brahmananda corrected him and replied that it was a mistake to think that sadhana could not be practiced for want of time. He said it's due to the restlessness of our minds. We have an enormous amount of uncontrolled mental energy that distracts us and weakens our focus. You know, our minds are always jumping from one thing to another, running, racing in a state of vibration. And according to Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras, that's the definition of the mind. It's a state of vibration. It's always in motion, not only while we're awake, when we sleep, when we dream, and even in deep sleep, our minds operate on another level. So it follows that busyness, the feeling that we have a great many things to do, often overwhelms us and devours our time. And instead of actually getting something done, we brood about all the things we have to do and haven't done. But our spiritual teachers remind us it's not a matter of the lack of time, it's the lack of the control of our minds. Again, Swami Brahmananda had said, we only need a very small percentage of our minds to accomplish the most intricate, difficult task. and still have time to do everything else that we have to do in life. So feeling busy is actually a mental state. Now, that's not to say that we are not genuinely busy. In our distracted state of awareness, we are busy. One of the main things that we are told that we have to focus on in our spiritual life is to try to control our thoughts and our prana and our energy, both of which we waste an enormous amount of, consciously and unconsciously. And we all know the benefits of focusing our attention on whatever we do. But however, this is not often easy when we're multitasking. I mean, after all, we only have one mind. And with that mind, we have to accomplish whatever we want to in this life, in addition to practicing our spiritual disciplines. Swamiji has repeatedly told us that there's no difference between our formal spiritual practice and our everyday life. It's we who make that distinction. If we are disciplined, and this is a word we tend to shrink from, and regulated in our work and our personal lives, our practices actually become easier. You know, when we feel we just don't have enough time to do our spiritual practice in a regular, timely way, we should seriously consider other aspects of our life. We don't seem to be too busy to eat, and we don't seem to be too busy to sleep, or too busy to go hiking or ride our bikes or talk endlessly on our phones, send text messages, etc. The list is long. We're all too familiar with our to-do list and how easily it becomes our not-to-do list because of other activities that take priority in our lives. Furthermore, as one of our late Swamis remarked, interest plays a vital part in our spiritual lives. He said, as long as our interest is primarily tied up to the external world, whether it's with other people or activities, it's not possible to quiet the mind and turn it within. Whatever we're interested in, we can watch, our mind automatically goes there. Everything then flows outside of us. Our energy, our thoughts, our will, our emotions. And then we begin living more outside of ourselves as opposed to within. So initially, I think we really have to ask ourselves, are we really interested in our spiritual practices or not? We have to be honest. Is it just a matter of routine, or we feel it's our duty? Because if we're really interested, honestly, nothing can hold us back. We will find some time in our daily life to do our practices, even if it's for a short period. And without daily practice, it's difficult, if not impossible, for us to become rooted in spiritual life. You know, we have to work hard to accomplish anything in life. I don't think anybody would doubt that. To become a doctor, to become a researcher, a professor, scientist, an engineer, whatever. But somehow, when it comes to spiritual life, we think it's different. We shouldn't have to make such an effort. But why should spiritual life be any different? If anything, practice is even more important because we're trying to turn the mind in an entirely different direction than it's used to traveling. Now, furthermore, Sri Ramakrishna says there are two conditions that are necessary for a spiritual seeker. And they're so simple that we tend not to give it much attention. And one of those two conditions? Sincerity and yearning. You know, he says we shed a bucket full of tears for our family, for our jobs, for our money, for our possessions. But who cries for God? Who has a sincere yearning to try to come into touch with the spiritual dimension of their being. How urgent is it? Do we really urgently feel that we need to do that? You know, in the Vedanta Sara, one of the Vedanta texts, it is said that when you approach a spiritual teacher, you should approach him or her as if your hair is on fire. That's urgent. So given these preliminary guidelines for busy schedules, here are three practices that I feel any person can do, no matter how busy he or she happens to be. You know, numbers always draw our attention. For example, in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you read about the eight fetters: shame, fear, hatred, doubt, pride, grief, conceit, secretiveness. And then we hear about Buddha's eightfold path: right thinking, right action, right meditation, right mindfulness, etc. And his four noble truths about the cause of suffering and the way to relieve it. And then there's Patanjali's eight limbs of yoga: yama, niyama, asana, etc. So whenever we're trying to connect ourselves with something vast, something infinite, it helps to bring it within our reach, something we can grasp. Otherwise, we're hanging somewhere in perceptual space. We need something tangible that we can hold on to and strive to achieve, and numbers help us do that. So this morning, we're considering three practices, especially for busy people. And what are these practices? Inspirational reading, manana, reflection, and karma yoga. I like to conceive of these practices like a triangle because they encompass all aspects of our personality. So the base of the triangle is inspirational reading. The left side of the triangle is manana, reflection. That appeals to our intellectual nature. Inspirational reading appeals to our emotional side. The right side of the triangle is karma yoga, work, action. At the tip of the triangle where the lines meet is the divine within us. So let's look briefly at this triangle. And we'll start with the base, inspirational reading. Sometimes we call it holy reading or devotional reading. Inspirational reading touches our heart. And I think all of you would agree, whatever touches your heart, your mind naturally tends to turn in that direction. It's soothing. It's reassuring. It's encouraging. And it's uplifting. It's a stimulus for our practice. For example, there's the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. There's Sri Sarada Devi and her divine play. There is Eternal Companion. This is the teachings of Swami Brahmananda. There's Four Seekers of God, conversations with Swami Shivananda, Mahapurush Maharaj. Both of these Swamis are disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. Or any conversation or reminiscence of other great ones. And in the last few years, so many books have come out about the lives and teachings of the various disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. This is just to name a few in our tradition. There are also many letters. The letters of Swami Vivekananda. The letters of Swami Turiyananda, which have been published under the title of Spiritual Treasures. They're full of practical, inspirational, spiritual instructions. And you know, although letters by nature are personal, these particular letters draw us in because the message, the teachings, the sentiments that are expressed are informal, they're conversational, and they're universally applicable. Of course, there are many saints and mystics in other traditions as well. It's our choice, whatever inspires us, such as the Alwars or the Nayanars of South India. There are Sufis, such as Rabia or Jalaluddin Rumi, and great Catholic mystics such as St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, or St. Francis of Assisi. Brother Lawrence in that wonderful book, Practice of the Presence of God. And then there are some from the Buddhist traditions. There's Nagarjuna, there's Milarepa, and Padmasambhavam. And also some from the Jewish tradition. We find these great mystics and saints in all traditions. In the Jewish tradition, we have Isaac Luria and Rabbi Yehuda Ashlag. You know, we often read situations that these great ones encountered, maybe problems that they had with people in their lives, their doubts, their joys, their sorrows, their conflicts and challenges of everyday life. And when we read how they solved their problems or what practices they did to lift their minds, we think, well, I can do that. It's within our reach. You know, in Vedanta, we hear and we read a lot about the need for swadhyaya. Swadhyaya is one of the niyamas in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. It's an ethical discipline. And usually it's translated as self-study or scriptural study. Now, swadhyaya as scriptural study is different from inspirational reading. You know, swadhyaya requires fairly intense concentration and a focused effort. And it often involves attending classes and lectures and discussions, asking questions, as well as independent study and memorization. For a busy person, it's often difficult to undertake this type of study on a regular basis. We cannot rush through scriptural study. It definitely takes time. And this is not to say that we should not do this type of study. It's important, and we should do it. But here we're talking about a practice for busy people. You know, our teachers often recommend inspirational reading in the early morning hours and in the evening before we retire, whether you're busy or not, as opposed to grinding through Shankara's Bhashya on the Brahma Sutras or some other philosophical text. Why? Because inspirational reading fills our minds with practical spiritual ideas and how these ideas relate to our particular situation. As Swamiji said, these ideas, they have to be incorporated into our everyday life. They have to be living. They have to be made real. Otherwise, how can they be helpful to us unless we can relate it to our situation and our life? And furthermore, inspirational reading opens our minds to another dimension of our being. It's almost imperceptible how this happens, but it happens. If we make this type of practice a daily habit, even for a short period, we will slowly notice the effect that it has on us over time. You know, the incidents in the lives of the great spiritual masters, their teachings for how to live a practical spiritual life in whatever situation we're in, their instructions, their reassurances, and probably most practically, examples from their own lives. It makes us reflect on why we have taken up spiritual life and practice in the first place. So these inspirational reading can act as sort of a map or a compass for our lives. It helps us make personal connections. It's not difficult to do, And it does not require one-pointed attention. It's refreshing and it soothes us. The more we read, the more we will wish to read. Now, when we combine this type of reading with manana, or reflection, say we are thinking about the lila, or the divine play of a great saint or a personality, something that we're reading. This is just a suggestion. We can read a few lines, and then we can reflect on what we're reading. You know, usually we just read through and we're done. But if we read slowly and we reflect on what we're reading and ask ourselves questions about what we are reading, such as who else is present in this situation? What are the surroundings like? This type of reflection makes a deeper impression upon our minds. And then we begin to feel that we actually have spent time with that person or in that person's presence. And perhaps one of the most important gains of inspirational reading is that it gives us self-confidence in our ability to move forward in our spiritual life. Why? Because we can relate what we are reading to our own life. You know, the ideas that we are exposed to through this type of reading are very helpful in the next practice, which is reflection. This is the left side of our triangle. You know, in Sanskrit, man means to think. Manana. And what do we mean by thinking? Well, how we associate, how we relate different ideas and concepts, and how we reasonably connect them or put them together. That's called thinking. And we can make a distinction between thinking and image making. For example, if you're thinking of an idea, you cannot hold or think simultaneously of another idea at the same time. For example, you think of a horse. We're talking about idea, not a particular horse, just the idea of a horse. You cannot simultaneously think also, say, of the idea of a cow or a goat or something. If you put them together, such as there are cows and horses grazing in the same field, fine, that's image making. That's not an idea. So here we're talking about ideas, not image making. So reflection, inspirational reading, this contemplation, deep thinking is different from meditation. We should make this distinction very clear. Manana is not meditation. And we often read in the scriptures, oh, we need to do shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Shravana is hearing, and manana is reflection, and nididhyasana is deep meditation. But here, we're only considering manana. When we reflect on the incidents in a saint's life or some spiritual idea, such as infinity or luminosity, immortality, or the qualities of reality, such as being one without a second, blissfulness, deathlessness, timelessness, a state beyond joy or sorrow. You know, we're not trying to focus our minds on just one idea, or to hold the mind to a single form or quality or sound. We are more relaxed and the mind is more responsive. It roams around in these ideas. By practicing like this, we take advantage of the mind's natural tendency to move from one idea to the next. And meditation is entirely different. You can say, in a sense, this is a preliminary to meditation. For example, give some examples. Say we are reflecting on Sri Ramakrishna's compassion, his friendship. You know, Swami Vivekananda wrote the beautiful hymn on Sri Ramakrishna, which is like a meditation, Kandana Bhava Bandana. There he describes Sri Ramakrishna as Yoga Sahaya. He's our dear friend in the practice of yoga. What a beautiful idea. And it's definitely something that we can think about. Manana. Or the Holy Mother's Sri Sarada Devi's unconditional love, her inability to see others' faults, her forgiveness, or maybe Swami Vivekananda's strength, his fearlessness, his boldness. Whatever it may be, the mind moves freely, dwelling on the form of the person, the rupa, or the qualities of a person, the guna, or the lila, or the divine play of that person, how that person interacted with other people under a variety of circumstances, what conversations or situations that they were in that provoked certain teachings. So the mind is given free rein during reflection, not so during meditation. Of course, the object of this practice is that the mind should roam within the realm of spiritual ideas, not what we're going to cook for supper or the next errand that we have to take. But we're not trying to hold the mind to a single thought, quality, or sound. To me, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna is a wonderful example of this type of reflection. M's contemplation, M is the recorder of the Gospel, his contemplation of Sri Ramakrishna. You know, when you read the Gospel, M has given such a beautiful description of the surroundings, the temple, the gardens, the Ganga, the devotees, Sri Ramakrishna himself and his teachings. It's very poetical, lively. It's not just a dry narrative. When you read his accounts, you feel as if you yourself are present in Sri Ramakrishna's room, or you're in the Kali temple, or maybe you're strolling through the fragrant gardens with him. Now, furthermore, reflection, it calms our minds. And it gradually focuses our attention on the divine. And if we earnestly persist in this, it prepares the mind for meditation. You know, meditation is a very sophisticated practice. And we hear a lot of talk about it, etc., but very few people can actually meditate. It requires long, consistent, and concentrated practice. We need to develop a conducive atmosphere within our own minds for meditation practice. It takes time to sufficiently calm our minds, especially when we live hectic, busy lives. We can't just rush around working all day long, this, that, come rush into our meditation room or the temple and expect to be able to meditate. But these other practices help us to go in that direction. Inspirational reading also helps us to understand why we are practicing, what we are practicing. In order to do that, we need some firm, legitimate convictions. And that comes through deep thinking. When we think deeply, then we become convinced in what we are doing and where we're going. So how do we do this? What's a practical way for us to practice this? You know, we can contemplate or reflect whenever we have a little time. Maybe between tasks, taking the bus or the train to work, during our lunch break, while we are busy doing some daily task that doesn't require our full attention. You know, there's so many times during the day when our minds are in autopilot or we're simply idle. And instead of constantly looking at Instagram on our phones, we can try to think these higher thoughts. There's a gain in this, because the more we think of them, the more frequently and naturally they will come to our minds. As we go throughout our day, we will form spiritual associations through our practice of reflection that we are then reminded of when we come into contact with certain people and objects and things in our lives. This is the advantage of it. And furthermore, during trying situations in our lives, during unexpected events in our dealings with people, when we're trying to make an important decision or we're trying to problem solve, we will be reminded of the various teachings and truths that our masters have given us. This is how we can slowly incorporate spiritual ideas into our daily lives. And eventually, this simple practice, with a little effort, becomes a habit. We need to learn to take advantage of the mechanical nature of our minds. And a profound lesson for us is that whatever we feel, the mind, whatever we feed the mind and whatever we feel in our mind, that it will give back to us. And that's why the teachers are always telling us, do not dwell on your past mistakes, do not dwell, et cetera, et cetera. Do not dwell on the negative aspects of your life, because the more you dwell on them, the deeper the impression goes into your mind. So they always instruct, you know, turn the mind in a different direction. Feed the mind with positive thoughts, and that's what the mind will give back to you. Now, the third practice of the triangle is the right side of the triangle, and this is karma yoga. Well, what could be a better practice for a person who's always working, who's always busy? Why shouldn't we make our karma, our work, a yoga? You know, again, karma yoga is a matter of dealing with the mind. It's a mental practice. It's our attitude towards our work that matters. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You don't have to change what you're doing to practice karma yoga. But we definitely have to pay attention to how we're thinking about our work. So when we try to make our work a yoga, whatever our work happens to be, whether it's whatever our works are, our outside jobs or our work in our homes or the temple or whatever, when we want to try to make any activity a yoga, we need to change our attitude, because it's how we think about our work that will transform it into karma yoga. And how we change our attitude depends to some extent on our temperament and perhaps also our karma. But the salient point here is that we have to spiritualize what we are doing. And how do we do that? By changing how we think about ourselves and how we think about our work. Now, earnest prayer to guide our understanding is a great help in this. This is based on the Gayatri Mantra. You know, Sri Ramakrishna used to say that the mind is everything. If you think you are bound, you're bound. And if you think you are free, you are free. That's really a profound statement that Sri Ramakrishna is making. It makes it sound much easier than we think it is, because thoughts are very powerful. So we have to be really mindful about how we think. In the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says that when our minds are under our control, it's our best friend. But if it's uncontrolled, it's our enemy. We have to befriend our own mind. Nobody else can do this for us. Now, in many ways, this is a tall order. We have certain fixed ideas about ourselves, certain images of who we think we are, or who we think we would like to be, or who we want others to think that we are. So we have to upend these self-centered notions about ourselves, accept them as such, and sincerely try to think of ourselves as a spiritual being. We have to try to imagine this in the initial stages. You know, Swami Turiyananda used to say, today's imagination is tomorrow's realization. It's your experience. It will become your experience if it's based on truth. And furthermore, not only do we have to make an effort, but we cannot expect to perceive the divine outside of ourselves and other people in the external world until we actually see it within ourselves and our own heart. Everything works from the inside out, not from the outside in. So obviously, trying to practice karma yoga has to be accompanied by other spiritual disciplines which support our attitudes, which in turn influence our work. We can't just think, oh, I'll go and do some karma yoga on a karma yoga day. Well, it doesn't quite happen that way. I mean, any work that we do that's not for our personal advantage or benefit is very helpful, but that doesn't necessarily make it karma yoga. Again, we often think that work is the problem, it's an obstacle. But that's actually not the case. The problem lies within us, not outside of us. So throughout the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna talks about karma yoga almost in every chapter. But in chapter 3, he concentrates on karma yoga. And he says no one can remain without work, even for a moment. And furthermore, he contends that through work alone can you reach the state of true worklessness. Only through work can you reach that state. You know, as we said in the beginning, our minds are constantly in a state of intense activity. And we can extend that to the entire universe. Everything is moving and changing constantly. There's nothing static in the external world or within us. So we can't escape work or activity or being in the midst of it. So let's try to do our work as thoughtfully as we can with a spiritual motive. Now, put simply, when we attempt to practice karma yoga or to make our work karma yoga, the main issue that we face is we should try to be unselfish. Our ego, our self, our opinions, all of these have to take a back seat. Now, obviously, this isn't easy. But the more unselfish we are, the greater amount of work we are able to accomplish. Swami Vivekananda says, what is karma yoga? It's the knowledge of the secret of work. What is that secret? Work incessantly, but give up all attachment to work. Do not identify yourself with anything. Hold your mind free. This is Swamiji's instruction. But unfortunately, this is the snag. We identify with what we do, and so we get caught. We get stuck. To let go of our personal investment and our opinions is not so easy. So it's this false identification with our small self and our big ego that is the stumbling block. This I and mine causes the whole misery, Swamiji says. With the sense of possession comes selfishness, and selfishness brings misery. Every act of selfishness or thought of selfishness makes us attached to something. Now, here in a nutshell, Swamiji has given us the secret, the answer to the secret of work, and he's nailed the obstacle that prevents us from understanding that secret. So that translates to our focusing on whatever work is before us, and doing it as efficiently and as with much concentration as we can, and then trying to stand aside and be as even-minded regardless of the success or failure of our work. Well, this latter instruction, again, is not easy, but it's not impossible. Even the attempt to work like this, it builds our character and strengthens our will. If we can mentally try to practice like this, we can gradually begin to make our work into a yoga. And as you know, any yoga to be effective requires practice. We may try and fail, or we may find ourselves falling short of the goal that we've set for ourselves. But as Swamiji told his disciple, Sarachandra Chakravarti, by performing disinterested work over and over again, even unwillingly, we gradually find the will is merging in it. And how do we perform disinterested work? Through persistent practice. We have to practice that which we wish to achieve. You know, even if you want to be a cardiac surgeon, how hard you have to work and study for years and years. You can't get sidetracked in some way or another or fall into mindless distractions. You also cannot show up at the operating room and announce that you're going to do the next bypass surgery when you haven't even graduated from medical school. Well, we all laugh at this ridiculous scenario, but this is exactly what we do in spiritual life. When we expect certain results without persisting in our daily practice. Even if we claim to be the busiest person, we still have to make some effort to succeed. You know, one of our swamis said in discussing the Bhagavad Gita, there's nothing like the yoga of inertia. Without effort, we cannot move forward. We have to make some attempt. Otherwise, it would be like jumping into your car with an empty gas tank or you haven't charged your car and expecting to go somewhere. It doesn't happen like that. So let's be honest. Let's ask ourselves, where is our attention focused? Toward what is our energy naturally flowing? If we can sincerely answer these two questions, we will know where our interest really lies. We have to know where our attention is focused and where our energy is flowing naturally. Then we will know. So in answer to the question, how do we perform disinterested work? By trying to be detached from the results of work. Simple. And additionally, if we are so inclined, to offer the results of our work to the divine or to the Lord, if you wish. Surely, all of this is a challenge. But since we all have to work, it's a practice that will definitely bring results over time. So these three practices support one another. Inspirational Rini, Manana, Reflection, and Karma Yoga. And they can be a part of every spiritual seeker's life, whether they're busy or not. Surely, somehow or other, we should be able to fit them into our daily practice. And with such promising results that are assured by our spiritual masters, shouldn't we at least try? Thank you.
Shantirantariksham Shanti Prithivi Shantirapa Shantihi O Shadaya Shantir Vanaspataya Shantir Vishwe Deva Shantir Brahma Shanti Sarvam Shanti Shantireva Shantihi Same Shantirehi Om Shanti Shanti Shanti
Peace is in heaven. Peace is in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters. The herbs, the plants, and the trees are all full of peace. The gods are peaceful. Everything in the universe is pervaded by peace. May this eternal, universal peace enter our soul and being. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us all, and to all beings everywhere.